Right. Well, I must say Happy New Year and good afternoon to my guest this afternoon, Tina Roach from Cambridge Cookery School. Hello, young lady.
Happy New Year to you, Mike. And I feel very happy now that I've been addressed young lady. Thank you.
It's always good to get off on a good start.
Yes, isn't it?
So you're with me. You've been away for a while. I seem to recall that last time I tried to get hold of you, you were so busy.
Probably training chalet staff in the Alps. Yeah, we're involved in the ski industry.
So. Oh, it was the Alps again, was it?
Sounds glamorous, but believe me, it's not. Yes. It's a hard week.
It's a hard life.
Inexperienced youngsters to cook for discerning clients. You know, it's not as easy as it sounds.
Pardon me if I don't quite believe everything that you say, but there we are. Anyway, Tina writes an article for Cambridge News every month, and what we often do is refer back to that article in terms of some of the things that Tina raises. And in this month's article, Tina, one of the profound things that you said was, rather than eating less in January, eat more.
Yes.
How come?
Oh, much easier, I think, to do it that way. First of all, I think, is there more miserable month to embark on a sort of extreme health kick? There really isn't, is there? It's dark, it's a long month, you know, we're suffering from a bit of a hangover from Christmas, and suddenly you just turn the tap off, you know, having had lots of lovely food and perhaps wine and drink in most people's cases as well, and you try to go to almost nothing. It would be much better to do it in August, I think, when it's too hot to eat.
Yes,
you know?
I agree.
But I think just eat more of the good things and you will not be so hungry and crave so much of the stuff that you're trying to avoid.
Now, there was the magic words, the good things.
Mm. Just more fruit and vegetables and more fibre.
Any particular vegetables and
no.
so on?
No? All of them. They're very good for you.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, don't think of vegetables as something that is an afterthought. You know, I think I fancy chicken tonight or, you know, I'm going to have mince-based meal. What can I add vegetable-wise then? Or maybe I'll have some carrots or some peas. Just turn the whole thing over and let the vegetable drive it. And
well,
then think, do I really need meat with this? Well, maybe I do, maybe I fancy it, or maybe I don't. But the main content of the plate can quite easily be plant-driven, and then you're already doing yourself such a huge favour.
I know, because you're a big exponent of driving meals from the vegetables first point
yes.
of view, aren't you, really?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm. So eating more vegetables and fruit and less carbs and sugar might be all well and good, but
yes.
Don't we crave comfort food at this time of year? So what can
yes.
we do to prepare and present food that looks appealing but has a lower calorie count?
Well, I actually, you know, I probably said the same thing to most of your questions over the past year that I've been here, Mike. The answer to me is always cook from scratch with seasonal and regional ingredients. And it sounds a bit like a cliche, or certainly a mantra in my case, but if you go to, say, the market square in Cambridge or in any kind of farmer's market around our area here in East Anglia, the products, luckily for us, are perfect for this time of year. So there's lots of root vegetables. You know, we have lovely potatoes from the Fenlands, but also things like celeriac, which is a wonderful, wonderful root to make soups from.
Full
of fibre, full of flavour, very filling, very satisfying to eat. Carrots, turnips.
But I was thinking more, yes, I understand that, right? But I was thinking more along the lines of how can you present food in a different way that makes it perhaps not look like, you know, your carrots and your potatoes and your broccoli and whatever, just makes it look a little bit more interesting. One of the meals that I cook for my wife is a pasta bake, which involves salmon and broccoli and mascarpone cheese as well, in a great meal that's very easy to make. Pop it in the oven, comes out, looks really, really tasty and so on. But in there, amongst everything else, is dear old broccoli, which, you know, you can't even see it, to be frank, when it's in there. That's what I'm thinking. Are the ways that we can dress up vegetables just to make it a bit more appealing, do you think?
I don't know how I can answer that without sounding possibly rude and condescending to you, Mike, but here goes.
Go for it.
I don't understand your question.
Oh, right. Oh.
But why do we think of vegetables as something that needs hiding, being snacking?
Right.
We are, honestly, okay. We have a big issue here in this country
yes.
that we have this attitude from the word go when we wean babies
feed
babies. And if you just travel to the continent and you look at most of the countries in mainland Europe, because we are also Europe, but we happen to be out in the North Sea.
Don't go there.
You know, children, babies, toddlers, and up to children and youngsters, they are fed the way I said. You know, you're eating regional and you're eating seasonal. So if broad beans, it's May and there's broad beans, there will be broad beans for breakfast, lunch and dinner. And children just grow up watching the adults enjoying them. They feed themselves off plates of it. Whatever's in season is what you eat. The whole notion that vegetables is something that we probably are born to dislike is absolutely bonkers, and it's ignorant. I'm really sorry. This is why I'm going to sound like I'm insulting you. It's ignorant, and we just need to get out of that completely ill-founded notion that it's something we won't like. So let's try and disguise them.
Last time, Latina's coming in the studio, listeners.
Yes, I thought so. I'm so sorry.
No, it's true though. It's absolutely true, because when you think of something like, say, sprouts or cabbage, I bet there's very few people that would put their hand up and say that's top of my list. Oh well, there you go. I know you might be one, but
again, this is going to sound really ignorant, but all I'm after is for people to realise that perhaps it takes a little bit of understanding of how to cook them. So all cabbages, of which sprouts are obviously one, they start to smell and they start to become rather unappealing if they're overcooked, and that is really past 2.5 to 3 minutes.
Right.
They go in the bin if they've been in anything after 3 minutes.
Yeah, but you see, this is what I'm getting at, is the
Before
ways that we can...
Before lovely.
You know, I've seen sprouts cooked wrapped in bacon and things like that, where it makes it just a little bit different and maybe a bit more tasty, but you don't think we need to have an excuse to eat vegetables.
You need to know how to cook them and which flavours they respond well to. And they are absolutely delicious. I mean, I've always had a household that are screaming, yes, sprouts! But it's because of how they're cooked. And if you think sort of boiled, soggy, in fact... Few vegetables, if we're talking about how to cook vegetables, very, very few vegetables, if any, benefit from being cooked in water.
Mm.
You know, water gives, you can imagine, it doesn't give anything at all. It doesn't add
anything.
Takes it away, yeah. Makes things soggy, limp, losing colour, losing nutrients. So
Steaming the best idea?
It doesn't really add anything either, I think.
So how would you do it then?
Pan frying, grilling.
Oh, really? Raw, so stir fry, kind of that sort of thing.
Yeah, or just put them in the oven. I would do sprouts is to just... They're not pre-cooked. You do not need to cross the bases. That is against the old foolish attitude that you need. Maybe if you've had them in your pantry for 5 months and, you know, you're coming into April and you're still hoping to eat your sprouts, and they would be very woody. But usually the varieties that you pick up today are lovely and little and tender.
How about microwaving? Would you steer against that as well?
I've never had a microwave. I don't understand why you'd want one.
We'll move on, shall we?
It's a device for heating things, but it's nothing to do with cooking.
Okay, not at all. See, this is the trouble with talking to an expert, listener. If we go onto some of those edges of cooking, it's not taboo.
A microwave doesn't cook. Yeah. It heats.
It heats. I can't do that. Okay. Let's move on, shall we? The other subject I wanted to talk about is flour. Now, you know, to a novice, an ignoramus like myself, flour's just flour, right? You get self-raising flour and plain flour, and I guess you get corn flour as well. But that's pretty much it, in my head anyway. But it's a lot greater. I mean, I saw a list on the internet of all sorts of flours. Bread flour, cake flour, pastry flour, whole wheat flour, oaked flour. I mean, masses of them. So just... Can you run us through kind of some of the different types of flour and why they are good and why they are not so good for making certain types of food?
Yes, and I think you're asking me this apropos of my article, which was mentioning a very healthy bread with fruits and nuts, but also dark chocolate. So it will look very indulgent, but is in fact incredibly healthy, as is the case with most homemade bread, and as is definitely not the case with any shop-bought bread at all. So the flours, the two categories, first of all. Plain and strong, if you like. So plain flour for your cakes and pastries. It comes from a strain of wheat that has very low protein levels, and therefore when it's milled and you cook and bake with it, it will have very low gluten. So gluten is, if you think of it as the structure of any bread or cake, it's what makes bread stretchy and lovely and chewy. The less gluten you have, the lighter and less chewy something will be. So obviously if you're making a light pastry or you're baking fairy cakes or a sponge cake, you don't want to have much gluten in there because you want that light, fluffy result. And it is also why you would be advised not to manipulate or knead or touch a pastry dough very much, you know, cold hands, all of that, is because the more you work it, the more gluten you develop. And once developed, that can't be taken out. So you're just going from tender to chewy the more you handle it, which is also why, you know, a food processor is really, really good for making pastry rather than struggling with your hands, because you've got a cold steel blade. It's done in 10 seconds and much easier.
So would the heat from your hands actually cause it to be more glutinous as well?
Well, it's easiest to do a quick process of, yes, cold fats into a plain flour, which means a flour with very little protein, i.e. very little gluten, and you will get a very light result. So there's no scaffolding in your house, if you like, or not very much anyway, and the rise will come from the whisking of something or a rising agent like baking powder. That is why it can hold itself up. For bread, you need a strong flour, so that comes from a strain of wheat which has high levels of protein and therefore high levels of gluten when you start to knead it. So gluten is something that the baker creates once it starts to mix the flour with a liquid, whether that is milk or water or whatever it is that you're using for your baking. And the more of that you have, the more structure and the more chewiness. So you definitely want it in your breads, but you don't want it in your cakes and pastries. So that's the main divider between the two strains of wheat. And by and large, the cold country wheat, say, you know, the Russian plains, Canada, you know, you see those bags in the supermarket saying Canadian strong flour. By and large, the strains of wheat that grow well and tolerate a very, very cold climate are the ones that have a high protein level and therefore lend themselves well for bread making.
Okay. So cake flour, you're saying sort of not strong flour to use for that.
Yeah.
Is that true also for pastry flour?
It's the same.
Or the same thing?
Yeah. Cake flour is just another word for play. There's two, if we're talking about protein levels and gluten levels and what they lend themselves to structurally, there are just two differences, plain and strong.
Okay, so what about whole wheat flour? Mm. Is there any great advantage in using that?
Not one at all. Not one iota. I would love to dispel this myth because people are being told that look out for whole wheat.
Right.
Well, unless it's whole grain, so that means 100% whole kernels.
So I was just going to say, what is the difference between whole wheat and whole grain? It's just the kernel, is it?
Well, if you have a whole, anyone listening thinking, oh, I'm doing really well here, I'm, you know, sticking with my brown bread or my whole wheat bread, I'm doing really well, but I would rather have a piece of white bread, but I'm struggling through, you might as well go back to your white bread, and then you can have perhaps a strip of pepper on it, and you'll have more of a fibre input than you would from your whole wheat bread. It's a complete marketing gimmick, unless it's whole grain. A whole grain has a hugely beneficial health effect on us because you will get the fibres that you need because the grain hasn't been milled. So everything is there. The endosperm, the husk, everything is there. And that has a very, very positive effect on us. But unless it says 100% whole grain, you can forget about buying whole wheat. You're just paying more money for a less tasty, I think personally, bread. There are other cereals that are much, much nicer to eat. And you're just eating something that's a little bit sort of a bit of a punishment to eat, and it's a bit cardboardy, and it's a bit sort of dull. There's no point, because there's a negligible health effect or benefit.
And what would you use that for? Bread primarily, or would you use it for, say, cakes as well? Or how?
No. Now we're into talking bread, aren't we?
Okay,
bread flour.
Okay,
so you were plain white flour really is your main ingredient for baking the classic pastries and so on. Of course, for a more healthy, cake, of course, or biscuits, you could add oats and other grains. But if we're talking the main differences in their structural behaviour, that's where I'm dividing it between plain and strong. If we're talking health benefits, you will firstly need the whole kernel, and it needs to say 100% whole grains, and there are hardly any normal sliced breads that have that.
Right.
Or you could go for sprouted wheat, which is incredibly good for us. Very few breads have that, but a couple of them, there are a couple of brands on the supermarket shelves that would say sprouted kernels or sprouted grains, and that's very, very good for us. Again, the fiber content is very, very high there. Otherwise, no.
Okay, a couple more breads and then we'll finish on flours rather, and then we'll finish on the flours and then maybe move to your recipe for bread there. Oat flour, what is that then?
Yeah, well, oat is good. Oat is a good cereal. Again, it hasn't got as much gluten in it as the wheat does. But really the super flour, which hasn't been listed here on your list, is rye. Rye really is extraordinarily good for us. Very, very low level of gluten, but absolutely jam-packed with trace elements and vitamins. Also tastes wonderful. So rye really is something that you could perhaps try to put at least 25-30% in if you're baking from any bread recipe. Just substitute, say, a third for rye, and you will have a much, much, much better for you bread. And I also think a nicer tasting bread.
And one on the list that I was really surprised at, I didn't even think it was a flour, semolina.
Yeah, but that's wheat again.
All right, okay.
So there's, you know... There's
I mean,
not,
I only yes. associate semolina with school dinners,
yes,
really.
Yes, but it's also often included, say, in handmade pasta making and so on. It just gives a slightly different texture, but it is a wheat product again.
And then finally, self-raising flour. Is there just one type of self-raising flour?
Yeah, because it's used for... It really is something that was just created, I think, for freeze. So it's basically plain. It's a cake and pastry flour. Plain flour to which... baking powder has been added. So I would never buy it because you have no control over its age. It's much better.
So what would you do? You just have plain flour and then add baking powder.
And then you have a little tub of baking powder, don't you, saying sell by date, you know, December 2017 or whatever, and you know. So it's rather pointless, I think. You might as well just have a plain flour and then you add whatever raising agent your recipe calls for. And it's only for cake and pastry making because, of course, you wouldn't use those raising agents for bread. You know, you use yeast if you're baking with bread, not baking powder.
Right. OK, then we'll break there just to have a look at how things are as far as traffic goes. And then we'll come back to Tina and we'll talk to her about this month's article in Cambridge News, in which she gives a recipe for making bread. Anyway, let's get back to where we were, Tina.
Indeed.
And talk about that bread that you've got in your article in Cambridge News.
Yeah.
Talk us through what the plan was with that bread.
Well, it was just to show that even what looks like a fairly indulgent bread will have huge health benefits, partly because you're baking it yourself and you're slow rising it, which is something else that perhaps we haven't got time to talk about today. But it is using spelt flour, and we've included a bit of dried fruits and some dark chocolate. Of course, dark chocolate is very good for you. It has no fat and quite a lot of good antioxidants.
Mm.
So the more, you know, the higher the cocoa content, the less fat. So when you go from very dark chocolate to sort of milk and down to white, you're moving basically from something that is very good for your health to something that is just pure cheap fats.
Right.
So dark chocolate is good. And this is, once you get into baking bread, you see, you know that there's a very kind of universal quality to it that is very the same for virtually every other bread that you make. And then you can vary it with different flours and adding things like dried fruits or nuts or seeds that are very good for us. So this was put in just to show that you can have something that seems very indulgent with a lovely fruit and chocolate bread. And you know, when it's fresh, it's obviously delicious. When it's warm and you have melting butter on it, it's very good. And of course, butter is good for us.
So how,
and when it gets a bit stale, it's lovely to taste.
How do you introduce the chocolate then? Because surely if you're going to put the bread into the oven, does the chocolate nut just melt?
Yes, a little bit.
Oh, right, okay.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, so it's a bit like when you're buying a panettone, say, you know, those.
Okay, yeah, right,
yes.
Right.
So that it will sort of melt out, but it will slightly hold its shape.
Right, okay.
Yes.
And the ingredients for this? Do you want
So here, the ingredients are always for bread. I mean, your key ingredients are just flour, water, yeast and salt. And I think, you know, if you keep that in mind, you can amuse yourself by looking at the packaging on supermarket breads. They can have up to 14, 15, 16 ingredients. All the others, apart from the first four key ones, are bad for you. They're preservatives, they're enhancers. It's really rather bonkers what gets added to bread, but that's because of the processed bread methods. So in this one, we have just a basic water-based, so, you know, again, for a more enriched bread, you might use milk. But here it's just water, and then we're using spelt, which is the original wheat, if you like. It's a wheat that hasn't been as genetically modified as a modern strain. So it is the wheat that the Romans would have recognised, say. And it has lower gluten levels, so it's often slightly easier on the digestion than those that are high in gluten. And it has a slightly nutty flavour as well. It's really delicious.
Now, I remember, I think we've talked about bread before, and I think one of the things that you said to me, I don't know if this is common for all bread making, but one of the things that you did say to me when I asked about how to prove it, most people would put their dough in a saucepan, not saucepan, a basin, and maybe put it in front of the fire or something like that just to allow it to prove for a while. But didn't you say to me about putting it in the fridge?
Mm. So the slower you rise the bread, the better it is, and the more we're going back to baking in the method that, say, old-fashioned bakers did and on the continent still do, where, you know, the baker would leave the bakery at 3 p.m. maybe in the afternoon having set all his doughs, and then his alarm would go off again at 3 a.m. and he would come in, and so often the breads would have been given anything between 12 to 18 hours of slow rising, and that does something rather miraculous to the gluten. It makes it much, much more water soluble, and it makes the bread much more easy to digest. So I am personally, my conviction is that a lot of the vague gluten issues that we're looking at today, where people don't have a big issue, but they feel a bit bloated. They're not sure they should be eating it. It's to do with the method of baking. It's not the gluten per se. It's the fact that it's never given enough time to break down and become more digestible. The other issue to do with digestion that I think people should be aware of, because it's so simple, is that a homemade crusty bread with a bit of chewiness to it will force you to chew. And when we chew, we are, you know, we are designed to function very well as a machine. We release saliva. And the saliva that comes down with whatever you've had in your mouth that has to go into your digestive system, its purpose, apart from being an emollient and, you know, making sure you don't cough up on your food, is that it has an enzyme which breaks down particularly fats and carbohydrates in your system. So it helps you digest. Most of our breads, certainly, that are shop-bought, they're so soft, as we all know. You could be eating it without almost registering it. You hardly need your teeth to chew it. And a lot of our processed food is actually like that. It hardly requires any chewing. And it is such a simple issue. But actually, if you don't chew properly, and I mean more than two or three gulps, you are not releasing any saliva. So it's going down fairly dry. And without that saliva, your gut is being deprived of an absolutely vital enzyme for digesting food.
So really the chewing, the end game for the chewing is to create the saliva, which then has all those other benefits that you talked about there. But essentially, chewing in itself is not the issue. It's creation of saliva is the main issue. Is that right?
Yes, and when you chew, you do create saliva.
Indeed,
but,
of course.
But all, you know, most processed food doesn't need much chewing. And the less chewing the food needs, the more issues you're going to have with your gut, because there is no enzyme going down with your food, and that enzyme is vital for a good gut activity.
So the recommendation there is, regardless of how much chewing you think it needs, chew it for a long time.
Absolutely, and again, then you're back to the benefits of upping your fibre. You know, your fibre will then lower your glycemic index. Your glycemic index is the rate with which the blood sort of turns the carbohydrates into sugar. So when you get the blood sugar swings, you know, it's 11 o'clock and you think, oh, I feel a bit shaky, I need a chocolate biscuit. That can be counteracted with high fibre food. So that's, high fibre is incredibly important and really, really good for us for so many reasons. And the chewing that it requires is just another benefit to us.
So often people, I mean, I'm not a person who has much in the way of a breakfast, but I know I've been criticised lots of times, oh, you must have breakfast and so forth. You're shaking your head, that's interesting. But would you therefore consider something like porridge oats to be high fibre?
Yes, porridge is really good. And I'm probably a bit controversial here, but I actually do not think that we need breakfast. I think a longer fast for the body is very, very good, sort of 16 hours, not eating until early lunch, is actually really good for us. But I'm not in any way advocating sort of, you know, crazy
doctor,
diet.
Really, yeah.
But I actually don't think that the old adage of, you know, breakfast like a king and, you know, lunch, etc., etc. I don't think so. I think exercise in the morning on an empty stomach, if you feel well on that, and then eating later on is actually very good, I think, personally.
Good. Okay, so your article in Cambridge News in January, all the details of that particular bread, including the list of ingredients and the method for baking and so forth, all in that article, yeah?
It is all there, and hopefully on our blog as well. We try to put all the articles on the blog. But it is a very standard bread. As I say, we run so many introductory classes for bread makers, and once you know how to bake basic bread, you can then experiment and have so much fun at home, just developing your own favourites and so on. You just need to get your head around the essentials, which are really simple, very, very pleasant. I think most people respond well to touching dough and kneading it. It's very tactile and lovely. And just the sheer alchemy of putting four very basic ingredients together. And an hour later, you know, you lift your cloth and you have this wonderful, soft, tactile bubble of dough. And most people think, oh, I can't believe it. You know, it's wonderful.
And the smell.
Yeah, and then the smell. Yeah. And the taste, of course. It's a delight dealing with bread.
Tina, as always, really nice to speak to you. Thanks ever so much for coming
in. Thank you for having me.
Back next month. We'll talk about something new in February. But do enjoy yourself if you're baking some of Tina's bread. And as I say, we'll be back with Tina next month. Thanks for coming in. There we go. That's Tina Roach from Cambridge Cookery School.